I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anelio, and you're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast, episode number 156.
Wow, that's a lot of podcasts. That is Patrick Hester. He's an author, a blogger, and a podcast dude. You can check out his website, atfmb.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at atfmb. My name is John Anelio. I write songs, and I compose music, and you can check out my music over at johnanelio.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at johnanelio. This week, we are joined by Chris F. Holm. His collector books recast the battle between heaven and hell as old-fashioned pulp novels. The third book in the series, The Big Reap, was released by Angry Robot Books on July 30th. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Hold on. Chris has been on. Anytime we mention Angry Robot, I have to do Angry Robot.
They're inseparable at this point, aren't they? This line in the name.
Chris, thanks for joining us. Chris has been on the show quite a few times now at this point, so we're happy to have him back, and because he's got a new book out. And why don't we talk a little bit about that first? So, The Big Reap. This is the third in the series now, Chris.
Yeah, that's correct. It's the third in my collector series. And it every book I try to give it a slightly different flavor. The first book was sort of wrong man conspiracy tale meets sort of angels and demons. You know, it was pulp crime plus fantasy. The second one I incorporated some buddy comedy elements and some Lovecraftian horror. And I promise the book's not as schizophrenic as it sounds. And in the third book, what I really wanted to do was incorporate and pay homage to all of the horror movies that warped my mind when I was a kid. Everything from like stone classics, like the original Boris Karloff Frankenstein, to the completely cheesy stuff that I was too credulous as a kid to realize was not very good. Poltergeist 2 comes to mind. There's actually a scene in the book inspired by Poltergeist 2. It features my main character who collects souls at the behest of hell, and he's tasked in this book with hunting down a group known as the Brethren, who are former collectors who performed a dark ritual to cast off their bonds of servitude, and in so doing became slightly monstrous creations and have shaped the whole of human history.
Was Poltergeist 2 the one with the creepy, tall, thin guy?
That's exactly right, yes. Okay. It was the one with the creepy, tall, thin guy. And the funny thing about my homage to Poltergeist 2, apart from the fact that I have one, is I'm not even sure that it was inspired by the movie. It may well have been inspired by the novelization of the movie, which gives you an idea of the childhood I had. That it, you know, the age of 10, I was reading the novelization of Poltergeist 2.
I remember the creepy tall thin guy from Poltergeist 2. There was also the creepy tall thin guy from what's the one with the balls where they came out with the spikes and they'd go right in your head.
Phantasm.
Yeah.
Phantasm. Yes.
That had the creepy tall thin guy. But the creepy tall thin guy in Poltergeist 2, he had cancer. And he actually died.
He was wasting away. He's part of the Poltergeist curse.
Yes.
That they've long talked about.
Yes.
And now, of course, they're remaking it. And I don't know who in their right mind signs onto that movie.
And of course, in order to build viral stuff, they immediately started talking about the weird things happening on the set.
Was there a Poltergeist 3 as well, or was there only a part?
No, 3 was in the apartment building. That's the one that after you watched that, you stayed away from mirrors for like weeks.
That's exactly right. It was nothing but mirrored apartment rooms and just like 2 hours of people running around shouting Carol Ann.
Yeah,
I feel like I saw that one in the movies when I was like in middle school. I feel like I went, that was like at a time when that's like your only way to get away from your families to go to the movies. And I went to see lots of movies through middle school and early high school. And I think I saw that even though I had no, and I know our main topic today is going to be horror films. And my contribution is going to be how I was I was a chicken and I did not like watching horror films, but I did go and see some because that's what you do when you're in middle school and early high school. You go see them anyway. And yeah, I have some stories about still being scared and I still don't really like horror films.
I've got a story about that too. But okay. Yeah, we can talk about that here in a second.
Cool. Well, anyway, so that is Chris's new book. I read the first book in the Collector series, which is excellent, and I highly recommend that you go and check them out. I give them the John Anilio stamp of approval, whatever that's worth. But it's I did really enjoy the book. It's exactly as he described it, an old pulp novel with the battle of heaven and hell. So check it out if that sounds like something that you'd be into. Let us get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
Patrick, why don't you go first this week?
This week, it's kind of funny. I probably should have picked this when we were talking about music with Jeff Patterson a couple weeks ago. My pick this week is the Tedeschi Trucks Band.
Ooh.
I don't know if you're familiar with them. Yeah, I've always...
It's Susan Tedeschi and Derek Trucks, who are a married couple.
They are.
But excellent artists in their own right.
So. Yeah. And Susan Tedeschi has been around for a while. And she has one of those voices that just sends chills through me. I've always loved her singing. And she's traditionally done blues. Mm-hmm. And Trux actually is the guitar player for the Allman Brothers Band now.
He is the nephew of Butch Trux, who is one of the original drummers of the Allman Brothers Band. So he is part of the Allman family, sort of.
And they met through music, obviously, and did get married, and she was still doing her stuff, he was still doing his stuff, and then they kind of started collaborating, and now they've released several different albums under the name, you know, the Tedeschi Trucks Band, and they got a new one coming out in August that I'm waiting for. I just love it. It's very the kind of music I like, and you know the kind of music I like, John. I'm more of a bluesy rock kind of guy, and that's what they're doing. And I actually snuck one of their songs into one of our past episodes at the end, not too long ago. I put one of their songs in there.
It's a big band too, right? There's a lot of people in the band. It's 13 people.
Yeah, well, it's basically they took the Daryl Trucks Band and they took the Susan Tedeschi Band and they kind of meshed them together and made the Trucks Tedeschi thing together.
I didn't realize.
Yeah, they brought everybody together because, you know, it's like they both loved their bands. And even though, like, he had his band and he was in the Allman Brothers and she had her band, they still, like, loved everybody in their bands. They didn't want to get rid of anybody. So they just kind of mushed them all together and created this new band. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit of everything, you know?
Yeah. Trux was actually part of Eric Clapton's band for a while, too. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you ever saw that. But Clapton, you gotta give Clapton a lot of credit for that because he had a band for a time that had Derek Trux playing, who's a fantastic guitar player, and Doyle Bramhill Jr., who's also an amazing guitar player. So Clapton's pretty cool. He'll put two guys that play even better than he does in the band and doesn't seem to have a problem with it. So it's really, really cool. And I will tell you this, speaking as a guitar player, Trux is a magnificent slide guitar player. I mean, there's no other way to describe. I mean, if you like slide guitar playing in particular and any kind of, like, he is unreal. Like, his tone, he's amazing. I mean, we use that word too much to describe people. He is nothing short of amazing. Like, go to YouTube, put Derek Trucks in. I'm sure you'll find something that is amazing. So if you like that stuff, it's great. So
when you buy the Tedeschi Trucks Band albums on iTunes, a lot of times you get videos. So you do get videos of them playing as well. It's cool stuff.
Cool. Very good. Chris, what is your pick this week?
Well, I think I'll keep the music theme going. Ben from Tyrus Books recently turned me on to a post-rock band out of Japan called Mono, who I don't know if you're familiar with. If you know Ben at all from Twitter, he tweets under Tyrus Books. You'll know he's a huge music nut, and he knew this was the sort of thing that was up my alley because I'm a big fan of sort of wall of sound shoegaze type stuff. And so he just harassed me until I checked out an album called Hymn to the Immortal Wind. And it's this stunning orchestral post-rock, entirely instrumental, produced by Steve Albini. One of the truly great producers of our era. And it is just this stunning, sweeping, epic, emotional music that is really the perfect soundtrack for writing. I'm not one to write with music on, but it has proven just unbelievably inspiring, and it can also be an exhausting listen, but it's magnificent. I'd highly recommend it.
Can you give the name of the artist one more time?
Yep, the artist's name is Mono, and the record that I've been really digging on is called Hymn to the Immortal Wind.
Okay, let's see. I'm looking at it on Spotify right now, and it's a Japanese experimental group?
That's exactly right.
All right, it comes right up. Here we go. And Hymn to the, Holy Ground Line. Oh, there we go, 2009. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm adding that because I love that stuff. So I'm like, well, I was going to say like, oh, email me that later. And I'm like, no, get it right now before I forget. Because, Chris brought up that the post-rock stuff, which, you know, a post-rock is typically instrumental, and it's sort of a rock band instrumentation of guitars and bass and drums and sometimes keyboards. But I think it is great writing music or reading music or whatever, because it is instrumental. And we were talking about in a recent episode about listening to orchestral soundtracks, and orchestral soundtracks are great too, obviously, but they're very dynamic, and there's lots of like quiet, you barely hear me, quiet, you know, and post-rock stuff tends to be, it's a vibe. It tends to be like you get sort of sucked into the sound, and it tends to be, and I mean this in a good way, it tends to be kind of repetitive. Like there's a lot of like little repetitive textures going. So it really can kind of get you into, at least that's my experience with most of the post-rock that I've listened to. So I'm always down to find out more stuff, more bands in that genre. So thank you, Chris. I will go and check that out when the show is over today.
And
so
he will too. He really
yes,
will.
Yes, that's, I did. No, I have my iPad sitting right here, and I just got it. I saved it to a playlist already, so there you go.
Yeah, and John just got the iPad, and so he doesn't miss an opportunity to say, you know, iPad.
Yeah, iPad. Okay, all right, well, and my pick real quick will be, speaking of the iPad, I used the Comixology app, and I read the first two issues of Saga by Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples. Someone at IO9 wrote top 10 reasons why you should be reading Saga. And I've been out of comics for a decade or more. And I'm like, well, that sounds like something I would be interested in. And the first issue was free, and I downloaded it from Comixology for free. And I bought the second issue, and it is fantastic. It's science fiction, but it's got like a real sort of Star Wars fantasy kind of vibe to it. And weird. It's weird too, but it makes sense, and it's great sense of humor, and it's great. I mean, really, all the praise that I've seen for this book is justified in the first two issues that I read. So that is Saga by Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples.
I have the graphic novel, the first volume, because basically what you said, because a lot of people have talked good things about it. Carrie Quinn talked about it. Mm-hmm. Galen Dara has talked about it. Jeff Patterson has talked about it. So, you know, a lot of people that I respect, and of course Jeff. I'll mention that was a good book. So, you know, I checked it out as well. I haven't read it yet though.
Vaughn is okay. One of those guys that for me is on my list of regardless what medium he's writing in, whether it's TV or comics, he's instantly a go-to for me. I fell in love with his stuff with Why the Last Man. And I just recently read about Saga. I'm not as up on comics as perhaps I should be, but I think I just read the same piece that you did, and I've been dying to check it out. So I'm glad to hear it's worth
issue number one is free on Comixology, and it's great. So
yeah, and see, I'm a snob about web design, and until IO9 fixes their fucking web design, I'm not going to read their website.
Come on, man, pitchforks. When we're talking about the 20 pitchforks. Yeah. Anyway, all right. Well, let us get on to our main topic. And as Chris mentioned when he was talking about his new book, there are many homages to horror films. So we thought we would talk a little bit about horror films today. And, Chris will probably mention some of the impact that they've had on his work, but we'll just have a little bit of a general discussion about that. So, Chris, you already mentioned the Poltergeist 2, homage that you have in the book. So what are, you know, were you a big horror movie fan growing up? Is this something that you got into later in life? Like how did this all work, and how did it, you know, eventually find its way into your book?
Well, you know, I think what's interesting to me about the way it worked into my book was some of it was by design. I really wanted to – every writer wants to have their crack at the classic movie monsters, be they vampires or Frankenstein's monster, werewolves. I just decided to do it all in one book. But once once it's sort of evolved as a motif, I decided I really didn't want to just generically tick off all those boxes. I really wanted to explore the stuff that scared the crap out of me as a kid. And that really kind of led me to revisit a childhood completely misspent, you know, watching midnight movies on cable with my one cousin who actually had cable. And just realizing that it had nothing to do with the quality of the movies I was watching, whether or not they scared the crap out of me. I guess I've always been a huge, huge fan of them. And it started with the cheesy, you know, I think Nightmare on Elm Street was probably the first movie I completely fell in love with in horror. And if you watch it now, it's almost quaint. It really is almost hokey, in a way, but it was just so marvelous and imaginative. And it was something I fell in love with very, very young. I don't know if you guys remember what the first horror movie that grabbed you was.
Well, I will, but as I mentioned earlier, I didn't like horror movies, and I still don't really watch horror movies at all. And I was a scaredy cat kid, and I guess I still am, because I never really got into them. But I went to go see Nightmare on Elm Street Part 3, which is kind of one of the campiest ones. It got campier, I think, as it went on, and 3 is pretty campy from what everyone tells me. And I wasn't scared while I was watching, because I was with my friends and I was trying to be cool, you know, because I was like in 7th or 8th grade or whenever it was when it came out. And I could not sleep for about 2 weeks after that. Seriously. And I've always been a great sleeper, and I was scared. It really terrified me, and I just kept like having images of Freddy Krueger walking into my bedroom. And I remember I had this little 13-inch TV in my room, and I would watch it to try to fall asleep. And I remember this was in the age where late at night they had the Lee press-on nail commercials. So like I have these images of like Freddy Krueger like scraping me and I'm about to fall asleep, and then it's like these like Lee press-on nails in my face. So I have sort of bad memories of the Lee press-on nails as well. But yeah, that did it for me. And so much so it was too effective. It was too good of a movie where it made me not want to watch movies anymore.
The very first horror movie, it wasn't really a movie, it was a mini series on TV. It was Salem's Lot. The original Salem's Lot from the 70s. Mm-hmm. And what has stuck with me to this day is the scene where the kid goes to bed and there's a knock on the window and his brother is out there floating in the air saying, it's cold, let me in. And you're sitting there going, you know, don't let him in. He's like, well, I'm not supposed to let you in, but it's cold, I want to come in. You're like, no, don't let him in. And then the kid walks over the window and you're going, no, don't open the window. And he opens the window. No, what are you doing? And then the kid floats in, and he smiles at his brother, gives him a big hug, and then bites him in the neck. You know, and that freaked the shit out of me. And
how is the floating not a warning there, for God's sake?
God. Yeah, it's like, well, you're stupid. You deserve to die. and that has been my attitude towards horror movies for a long time now. It's like whenever I watch a horror movie, it's like, oh, that person is stupid and they're going to die. And one of the things that I did, 14, 15, 16 years old, we used to have Fresno Video. And Fresno Video was just down the street from where I lived. And we had an account there. It was you had accounts in those days. And you would go down and you would rent videos. And, of course, they're not supposed to rent anything R-rated to kids. But it was the 80s. And, of course, they don't really give a shit. And I would go there all the time. And I actually decided that it was ridiculous to be afraid of scary movies. So I went down and I rented every scary movie that came out. And I watched them. And I forced myself to watch them so that I would, you know, kind of become desensitized to it. So that I could watch them, enjoy them. And then, of course, then you start realizing the tropes. And so, you know, one of the tropes in those movies eventually came through in like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the TV show. Joss Whedon was always about like, well, the classic horror trope is if you have sex, something bad is going to happen to you. And so on Buffy, of course, Buffy loses her virginity, Angel becomes Angelus and starts killing people. You know, and that's the whole horror trope. It's like, oh, look, it's kids and they're going camping. Oh, those kids are having sex. Well, nothing bad's going to, oh, they're dead.
I almost feel like that it's the modern version of that classic morality tale, right? I mean, yeah. These are the horror comics, you know, of the 40s through 60s were essentially the same way. It's these very simplified morality tales that sort of suggest to you, if you live your life according as you should, no real harm will come of you. And if you step off this path, terrible things will happen. But one thing that's always struck me, too, is that what I consider a horror movie is not necessarily what everybody else would. Like, I think one of the most effective horror movies in history is Jaws, which is really essentially widely considered to be one of the one of the greatest summer blockbusters of all time.
Now, you know, see, I was able to watch Is that the Green Lantern guy that you have there, Patrick? Yeah, there you go. You really distracting and anyway, you realize it's wildly distracting and no one actually gets to see that when there's the podcast. But anyway,
it's not meant to distract the listeners. It's meant to distract you and the guests.
Well, mission accomplished. See, I watched all the Jaws movies, and while I was scared watching them, I never had a problem with them because I knew my bed was not in the ocean, and I knew a shark wasn't going to come and eat me. So I was sort of a smart enough kid where I realized, like, all right, well, there's nothing to be afraid of because I'm not in the ocean. But you're right. It does scare you, like, the way that Jaws comes up. And that, you know, that kind of – well, why don't you finish your thought, because I'm about to, like, go off the rails there with something else. So, Chris, why don't you finish what you're going to say about Jaws there?
I was just going to say I probably shouldn't confess this, Red, after you said you were a smart enough kid. I was not a smart enough kid to realize that. One of my earliest memories of a horror movie is I was a bit of a latchkey kid. I remember my parents leaving me to go do some errands for a little while one evening in an apartment I was in. I must have been in first grade. And Jaws was playing on our black and white television. This was the edited for TV version of Jaws. So it was no blood, no real anything terrifying. And I remember I was sitting on the couch with this blue shag carpet that sat in front of the couch, and the TV was across the room. And I was so terrified while I sat there watching that movie that I had my knees drawn up to my chest, and I refused to let my feet dangle over the couch for fear that the shark would get me.
Well, yeah,
do
you're
with
a kid,
that information you, what you will.
Yeah, you're a kid. Your imagination is just absolutely wild. You could see that shag carpet as being water.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right, and I think that's what I wanted to capture in my book. Is not what's funny is I think that the last book was far more of a horror novel than the new one. The new one I think is more of a pulp adventure. It whisks from place to place, and my main character is tasked with hunting down these creatures. It's really not straight horror like the last one was in parts. But I wanted to capture that sort of dreamlike quality to those early horror experiences you have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, what I was going to bring up in regards to Jaws, recently, George Lucas and Steven Spielberg had kind of had like a little bit of a press conference. They were talking about how movies being made these days are, you know, it seems like most of the major studios, years ago it would work where they would make a lot of movies for, let's say, $30 or $40 million, like a big budget, but they'd make a lot of movies in that range. And now it seems like instead of making all those budget movies, but they're like mega temples where it's like, we're going to spend $250 million on this, and we're just going to hang our hat on that. And it's all about sort of appealing to the world market, not just the United States, because if you have a movie that can really appeal worldwide, you know, you can make a lot of money. And basically what they were saying was, well, that's fine if it does well, but if you, all it's going to take is three or four of these to really tank, and then where are we going to be? And I think we're starting to see that a little bit already.
And John, just to understand, they have re-released that press conference with all new footage. And they changed a few things, you know, like 21 seconds. It's a completely different news conference now. Yeah. But when you look at the budgets of a lot of these movies, what is one of the most successful horror movies of the last, say, 10 years?
Would it be the Paranormal Activity?
Paranormal Activity.
Yeah.
And I watched that movie, and that was one of the first movies in a long time that scared the living shit out of me.
Agreed.
And not only because I was sitting in my dark living room watching it, you know, with all the lights off, and you know, I've got the stairs and my house creaks and makes noises and stuff, you know. And so, and at first I didn't realize what they were doing with the low baritone bass thing. You know, there would be like people talking and stuff, and then they would cut to the screen and like a camera shot, and then all you, so you just hear, that's your cue, shit's about to happen. Well, I didn't realize that at first. And then, you know, it's like you're leaning in. You're leaning in. It's like, what's going to happen? And then, boom, something happens and you're scared to death. But, you know, that movie cost like $25,000, some ridiculously low amount of money, you know, to make. But spawned, you know, tons of sequels and made them tons of money. And it just goes to show you don't need Jason in the woods. You don't need Freddy in your dreams. You don't need, you know, well, you do need Pinhead, but that's a completely different story. you can scare the hell out of people for just a little bit of money. You know, you got something like The Conjuring, which is out right now. It's like the number one movie as we're recording this. And, you know, that is, and this goes back to what I've always said about horror movies. The best horror movies are the ones about Catholics. And I mean, Catholics, you know, I grew up Catholic, and just there's so much stuff to play with there. Exorcist and, you know, The Conjuring and you know, demons and possession. And all, those make the best damn scary movies, really. And that's The Conjuring. You know, it's the same kind of stuff. The house is possessed and there's all this freaky stuff going on.
I'm really interested to see The Conjuring. And one thing that I find sort of fascinating about it is his previous movie Insidious, I think, is a highly underrated work of absolutely terrifying horror that, granted, has some third act problems. I think horror functions best when unexplained, and I think the attempts in that movie to explain the phenomenon that you and the protagonist experienced maybe fell a little flat, or at least shifted it from a straight up horror movie into something a little schlockier. But he had his roots in some very, very violent movies with the Saw franchise. And then as I think his skills as a director and as a I guess, purveyor of horror have increased, they've become more bloodless affairs. They become scarier affairs. And I think that's kind of an interesting transition to make career-wise.
You know, and what I was going to bring up, and the reason why I brought up Spielberg is because on another podcast I was listening to, they were talking about, you know, if they remade Jaws now, they were sort of talking about what they would do. And there it would totally lose its effectiveness because you don't really see the shark at all, like for much of the movie. And it's such a big buildup. And part of the reason for that was because the initial sort of machine that they had to be the shark, couldn't get the budget together for it, or didn't look that good, and they, you know, so that was the reason why they made. So a lot of times, I think as artists, you can really play your limitations, budgetary and otherwise, to your advantage, and I think that's why Jaws is so effective. And they were talking about, well, if they released Jaws now, first off, it would be in 3D, and you would have the shark just gigantic, like, you know, just killing somebody within the first minute of the movie, and, you know, because it's like, we spent money on this movie, but bam, you know, and you know, from a storytelling point of view, it doesn't always work, you know.
They already did it. It was the one where the shark jumps Jaws up 3. And eats. No, they where the shark jumps up and eats Samuel L. Jackson.
Oh yeah, movie. What was the, I do? I don't remember what it was called.
Yeah, I mean,
LL Cool J was in that movie too.
Yeah, it would be Sharknado. Like shark, yeah, it'd be Sharknado. You know, they just released Sharknado, and now they're going to do Sharknado 2, you know.
Well, Sharknado is very aware of what it is, though. I heard an interview with the director, too, and they realized the ridiculousness of what they made there.
And we get desensitized, but we also, I want to say, we get a little bit more sophisticated, you know, as time goes on. And what, you know, the giant monster movies of the 50s aren't going to scare people today. Because now people are too cynical. They're like, giant monsters, that's not that, you know, that can't really happen. So you know, you get something, I think that it, as you kind of come down in scale and you start to get into people's heads a little bit more, that's a little bit more scary than monsters, you know, because monsters tend to be campy now.
Yeah. Well, and I think most people, and I think I imagine a lot of people in our audience, you know, probably were more scared reading a Stephen King novel than they probably ever were reading, than watching a movie, you know?
Well, I've told you my Stephen King story.
Please recap it.
Remember the book?
Oh, yeah,
it?
Yeah.
So I was living in a house that I was a kid, and we didn't have a shower. We had a bathtub.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this copy of It that someone had given my mother and said, you know, oh, your son likes to read here. Well, you know, she didn't think age appropriate. She didn't think anything about that. And mm-hmm. so I have It. And I actually took it and sat in the bathtub and started reading it. And I'm reading about a guy sitting in a bathtub. And then bad things happen to the guy in the bathtub. As mm-hmm. And so that was it for me. No pun intended. Mm-hmm. I never read any Stephen King again until like The Dark Tower. I mean, it just freaked me out. It's like, I am sitting in a bathtub and there's bad things happening to someone sitting in a bathtub. No, no more. It's like, that was my Joey moment. Let's put the book in the freezer where it can't hurt me.
Yeah. Well, I think quite often art, the most effective kinds of art are the kind where you as a reader or a listener or a viewer can sort of put your own feelings into it. You know, a lot of times people really love albums, and what they tie into that album isn't necessarily what the songwriter mm-hmm. meant by it, but you have your own feelings on it. So yeah. So anyway, that could be for another day, but running out of time. So let's wrap it up here. And for me this week, check my website out, johnanilio.com. Lots of music there to download for free. And you can follow me on Twitter at johnanilio. Chris, you have your new book, which is out now. Any conventions coming up? Anything, other projects that you want to tell people about?
I'll actually be at Killer Nashville at the end of this month, which is going to be a blast. It's everything from mystery to horror to fantasy. And then this fall, I'll be at BoucherCon and a couple other conventions.
When you say this month, you got to understand that we are doing a timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly thing.
That takes the timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbliness into account. It's actually at the end of August.
Awesome. Okay.
Good. Okay, so people will hear this before then. So very good. and then The Big Reap is out now, and very cool. And what's your website and your Twitter handle, Chris, so people can check
my
you out.
Twitter handle is at Chris F. Holm. My website is chrisfholm.com.
Oh, easy enough. Very good. Easy okay. Enough. Yeah. All right. Patrick, what do you have going on this week?
Just go to ATF&B and check stuff out. I'm gonna finish this out with one more story about horror movies. My cousin and I would chat often on the phone. He was living in Tucumcari, New Mexico, which is, anybody who's ever been in Tucumcari, New Mexico is aware, is the middle of nowhere. And one night I decided to call him. One of the things that we would do, John, is we would call and we would actually talk about music and songs that we were writing, and we'd play guitar and work on stuff over the phone. And so one night I called him. And normally he would pick up very quickly, but on this night, he wasn't answering the phone. And it was just ringing and ringing and ringing and ringing and ringing. And I'm going, what the hell's going on? And he didn't have voicemail or anything. It just kept ringing. Finally, he answers the phone and very, very, very timidly says, hello? I'm like, Steve? Immediately starts laughing. And I said, what's going on? He's like, well, I just put a movie in. I said, okay. And he goes, the premise of this movie is that you watch a video and then the phone rings. And after, when you answer the phone, you've got like X amount of time before you're going to die. It's The Ring is the name of the movie.
Yeah.
He's like, so I'm watching this movie and these two girls are talking about this video that they're watching. And they start watching it. And then their phone rings, and I heard ring, and then I heard ring behind me. And on the screen, it went ring, and then ring behind me. And on the screen, ring, and then ring behind me. And I'm like, what the hell's going on? And I hit pause on my VCR, and then I heard ring behind me. And he's like, so I was trying to decide what the fuck was going on. I got up. And I walked over to the phone, and it kept ringing, and I answered it, and it was you. And I said, ah, you have 32 hours before you're going to die. And he said, that's not funny. But anyway,
just
that's
as a
my
aside,
That's my horror story. So yeah, so I unintentionally I completely freaked out my cousin who was watching it.
I don't, you know, my wife, she'll probably kill me for saying this, but when we finished watching that movie, she refused to keep the actual DVD in the house. it was like midnight on a Saturday, and she was like, we are getting in the car, we are dropping that in the Dropbox. This was in the days before Netflix. We drove to the video store. I told her it was already too late at that point, but she'd hear none of it.
I can almost top that because my other cousin, Mandy, went with all of her girlfriends. They went to a 12:30 a.m. screening, the first screening of the Blair Witch Project. And after they walked outside and the gigantic parking lot was empty except for their cars, and they all had to walk by themselves to their cars and then go home. They were all freaked out.
Yeah.
Absolutely freaked out. And she said she didn't sleep that night at all.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a good cap for our horror movie.
Yes.
Chat,
yes.
John.
Yes. Very
Take
good.
It
all
home.
Right, everybody. All right. Well, thank you for joining us this week. You can check out Patrick Rose at atfmb.com and follow him on Twitter at atfmb. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Yeah, I'm assuming you're going to put that right in.
If I attend church only Sunday, Lord, I come back home and I wanna raise hell all day Monday. Lord, it ain't nobody's business. If I do, oh yes, sir, if I do, oh no, 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 if my baby comes up to me and says I ain't got no money, I just gotta reach into my pocket and say, that's what I want to do. Oh, no, 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 no. Oh, ain't nobody's business. It just ain't nobody's business. Oh, it ain't nobody's. Oh, nobody's business. Oh, what I do. my heart was bleeding, and it hurt my bones too late. Stayed in the city, no exception to the rule.
Still here? It's over. Go home. Go.